Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And we would like to welcome you to the summertime. We are here in Edinburgh, and we celebrated our summer by getting married.
We had a beautiful ceremony in the garden in Rennes-le-Château on July 22nd, with a lot of our friends and family there, and it's been a very beautiful summer for us.
Absolutely. But the summer, of course, has been dictated up until a few days ago by the Olympics, which have been happening in London and which we narrowly escaped by driving when we were driving past London. But it's really been beautiful to see Britain come alive, apart from Danny Boyle. There have definitely been things about the Olympics. And just before coming on air, I was looking at some Google Plus feeds in which basically somebody was saying that the Illuminati were going to plan a false flag invasion during the Olympics. And basically he was saying that because the coverage had been so widespread that all the conspiracy people had been exposing the possibility of a false flag or a fake alien invasion at the time of the Summer Olympics, that this now didn't happen. I mean, if there were aliens who were going to invade during the London Olympics, I think that the opening ceremony by Danny Boyle was probably what put them off more than anything else. But, you know, there is this thing that the conspiracy treadmill is definitely part of our lives now, that it is always there, and that people try to explain certain things in a number of ways, which is kind of sad. I think that it once again is all about creating fear, and there's enough fear in this world without the conspiracy theorists adding to this. They quite often think that they are doing a service by pretending to expose evil plots by the government, but actually they are the fear mongers. They are the ones who keep people in line by saying that anything they do is basically futile, and then when nothing happens, they actually take credit for the fact that nothing is happening. So when there is nothing to fear, it's up to them, but we nevertheless should fear because the people are apparently plotting to do certain things. I personally think that leaders of the world, if they did want to do something, they would definitely not try to do it during the opening ceremony of an Olympic Games when they're all there, and they would look really bad themselves. But that's just my two cents. It's definitely something which has been dominating this year, and now in post-Olympic mode, I believe we are on day two of post-Olympic 2012. We really need to I think get back to reality. And the reality is that we did spend an awful lot of traveling over the summer, and we visited many sites which we love and adore, but also added some new sites into it. And the two of us had never gone to Lourdes, and we rectified that problem by going to Lourdes. So we set off from the south of France, and who's going to give their first impressions of Lourdes? You or I?
Well, you know, Lourdes is a place that I have narrowly missed on a number of occasions, and people always ask me when I talk about where I am in the south of France, I hear all the time the question, oh, you're close to Lourdes, and you know, how do you feel about Lourdes, or I've always wanted to go to Lourdes, or I'm dying to go to Lourdes, or my mom wants me to go to Lourdes. You know, I think that we all have this, and certainly Philip and I, having both spent a lot of time investigating and researching Marian apparitions, visions of the Virgin Mary or of some divine lady that have happened in Europe. Lourdes is certainly the most famous or the most publicized and celebrated of them all. So for a long time, I've really felt like I needed to do this. And I've always had some trepidation. I always had this kind of thought in the back of my mind that, oh, I'm not going to like this very much. And if you read the Book of Love, you probably know why. I talk a lot in the Book of Love about how I feel a lot of these amazing young girls who had visionary experiences were really exploited by the church after they had these experiences. Certainly none more terribly than Lucia Santos, who was kept in solitary confinement after her visions in Fatima. Bernadette Subaru certainly fares better and becomes quite the darling of the church when she has her visions. So she is not locked up, and it's a very different story for her. But I I think that I've avoided Lourdes because I felt that I was going to find exactly what we did find, which is a tourist trap. More than anything I think I've ever seen in France, it is a carnival. It is a sideshow. It is a lot of snake oil being sold there for a very, very large amount of money. But I'll let you give your description of it because I think you hit it on the head when you described it to me.
Well, I think the description which I gave was twofold, and I gave the description after having seen the first aspect of it. And the comparison was to Las Vegas, because in Las Vegas, if you want to gamble, there are casinos pretty much across the world, but most of them have opening hours, which is pretty much late at night into the night itself. Las Vegas changes that. Las Vegas gives you 24/7. And the same thing is with churches. Most of them, have services mostly on a Sunday, but it's not 24/7. And if you want to go to a church, basically you have to pick the service. There's one at 10, then the priest, will take a break, and there might be one in the afternoon. Not so in Lourdes. You just missed this mass? Well, there's another in 15 minutes, and probably in a different language. Do you want to have mass at 5 o'clock in the morning or at 7 o'clock at night? Do you want to take in all the that kind of aspect is what made me initially conclude that it was like Las Vegas for the church. Then, of course, we went into Lourdes Village and realized that we were oh so wrong, in the sense that it really is like Las Vegas, with hotels shouting at you in typical Vegas style, come in here, buy your statues here from shops. They are shouting at you to kind of like, with neon lights, to buy and come in here, eat here. It really is. There's nothing pilgrimagey like about it, even though you have people and you see that around the sanctuary itself who've come from very far, in a kind of procession, with a priest quite often accompanying them. Lots of people who come there because it's clear that they have certain ailments or certain fears about their personal health or about the health of people that are which are dear to them, and they all come in there, but it's like. Saying we're going to hold an intimate service, we're going to do this in a place, and would you please come? And we send out the invites, and then really all of you guys are coming, and then you find out that we've hired a circus ring, and the only thing which is really missing from Lourdes is the clown, and I'm pretty sure that on a number of occasions there actually are clowns running through the town as well. It's not peaceful. It's a circus. There is no intimacy about it. There is no moment of reflection. We went into the little grotto where the apparition appeared, and you go past it. There's no atmosphere. And what I actually felt sad to some extent is that you're being looked upon by people who do actually want to spend time there, but they're not allowed near it. So there's this weird world happening there whereby tourists and pilgrims go and touch the rocks, but then at the same time, if you don't want to do that, which seems to be the people who actually just want to meditate, you're not allowed to be in there. So you're stared upon by people who are sitting further away. On that place, but who not necessarily part of what you're doing, so they're not part of this pilgrimage. They sit behind a barrier, on a bench, which gives it a very kind of like dualistic, weird atmosphere, of when you're actually kind of like in the place of the apparitions themselves.
Well, there's also, in addition to the 50 million masses that are going on in various sanctuaries within the sort of Lourdes structure, there's also all this external stuff happening. There's these external services happening over microphones and bullhorns. And then there's this sort of weird assortment of volunteers, mostly older Catholic women, who run around and shush you because they're trying to control the environment and they don't want you to talk while the service is going on. Now, the reason this is ridiculous is that there are thousands of people in this space, and these little ladies are running around, and they're very aggressive, by the way. At one point, I was talking to Shane, my 10-year-old son. I was responding to him. He'd asked me a question, and one of the Lord's police, which was an older woman. She wasn't French. I think she may have been Spanish. Came over and started pulling on my purse. I mean, really tugging on it. At first, I actually thought someone was trying to rob me. And I turned around and she was going, you know, meanwhile, there are 200 other people within, you know, 100 feet of me all talking. And I thought, wow, this is a really interesting errand she's on. She's going to try to make everyone here be quiet. And what I really wanted to do is I wanted to have a bullhorn and be able to say in 50 languages, what would Jesus do? Because I don't think this is the spectacle that he was necessarily looking for. Nor do I think that this is what Bernadette had in mind when she told people that she had this beautiful, amazing, mystical experience with the Divine Mother. But for me, ultimately, it comes down to this whole moneylenders and merchants thing. I mean, when I was in Lourdes, all I could really think of was Jesus turning over the tables. And that goes back to my what would Jesus do response. There are these kiosks everywhere where this, in the same places that the little Catholic women are shushing you, they're also taking your money and lots of it. So, for example, there are a lot of places to buy bottles so you can get your holy water, which now comes out of taps. I mean, you go and you turn on the taps and the holy water pours out of it. But the big ticket items in this part of Lourdes are candles. So it's all about candles. I'm not talking about your 1 euro votive candles that you see in the churches throughout France. I am talking about candles that are bigger than me. I'm talking about candles that cost hundreds of euros. Yes, you can get smaller ones. There's the 5 euro, the 10 euro, the 50 euro, the 100 euro candles. But there are signs in multiple languages on these kiosks that say, your prayers will be heard longer and stronger if you burn candles in Lourdes. And that to me is flat out snake oil sales. It's come and spend hundreds of dollars on our gigantic candles, and we're going to promise you that your prayer is going to go directly to the front of the line. This to me is exactly what Jesus would have turned over tables for. I was absolutely appalled by it.
And they have like nice innovations, which is like automatic candle dispensers, which is definitely unique, I think, or at least if it's not, it's very rare. I had never seen an automatic candle dispenser, nor do I specifically want to see another one. But there were some interesting things there as well, because I guess the Lord works in mysterious ways. As we were leaving, and we were, I think it was about half an hour before. Well, when I say closing time, it's like Las Vegas. It never really closes. But before, when certain things close, we were leaving. And as we were leaving, we saw a gigantic billboard which said, I think in French, the Shroud of Monopolo. Monopolo, I keep mispronouncing that word, which is something which Kathleen and I have been not obsessing about, but it is one of those things which keeps being thrown at our face. We realized about its existence actually on my birthday this year, when we, apart from dinner, went into the LA Cathedral and stumbled upon a book which dated back from 2006 by a German author. The book has been translated into English, and he talks about his studies of this, and basically it's the first book which pushes this into the forefront. And what the book is about, and we will go into detail definitely in another episode of The Spirit Revolution, for reasons which will become clearer later in the show. Basically what it is the Veil of Veronica, or a contender for the Veil of Veronica. And this veil sits outside of Rome, roughly just over 2 hours, in a tiny little hilltop village, almost literally in the middle of nowhere. Today there is a good motorway to there, but before it was really hours of curves and turns in hilly landscape. And so what happened was that this tiny little village town church laid claim to having the real Vale of Veronica. They claimed that either in the 16th or 17th century, somehow the Vale of Veronica had been taken from the Vatican, where it officially sits in one of the pillars above the main altar in the Vatican Church there, St. Peter's. And so it was somehow taken from there and ended up in this small village. And so what happened was that this German journalist who was stationed in Rome became interested in this, went there, made contact with a German nun who for decades had been obsessing about this, and who is actually extremely instrumental in making sure that people know about this. And she actually was a nun who had taken vows of silence, but her congregation actually allowed her to talk because they felt that her mission was more important than a vow of silence. And then in more recent times, she actually left her nun. She left her her nunnery in Germany and settled in Monopolo itself, where she basically goes to look at and study the Vale of Veronica or the Vale of Monopolo on a daily basis. And I think to some extent, her work together with Paul Budd's work, who is the German journalist, is why Lourdes decided to stage a minor exhibition on this, which was very interesting, which basically showed you how this veil incorporates with the various other things like the Shroud of Turin. And without going into too much detail, the interesting thing is that our beloved sister, who did all of these things about the Veil of Veronica in Monopolo, what she did was she took photographs, and in the day before Photoshop, she superimposed these on the Turin Shroud, and she came away with the realization that the face on both the Shroud and, I'll keep referring to it as the Veil of Veronica, are identical. And of course, this brings into focus the fact that we now have three correspondences, the Veil of Veronica, the Turin Shroud, and also, of course, the Oviedo Sudarium, on which we reported about and which we were with on Easter of 2011. Go into our archives and you will find our discussions from Oviedo at that moment in time about it. So it appears that another veil is to be added, and we're not leaving at that.
This veil is really, really fascinating for a lot of reasons, and I can't really believe it's escaped our attention up until now, but we were certainly excited to find it. But what, you know, there's an amazing sort of energetic thing that happens here. As soon as we discovered it, all of a sudden it was like the floodgates opened. We had never heard of it, no one ever said a word about it. We stumble upon this book, and the next thing we know, boom, all of a sudden it starts to show up. We start getting information. All of a sudden, someone out of the blue will say, "Hey, do you know about this?" I got an email from a friend and very respected colleague in the world of Magdalene research recently, just out of the blue, that said, "Do you know about this veil?" "Yes, I do, and we're excited about it." She's actually been working on it for quite some time. We're not going to say too much because we're actually going to do a show specifically on this issue coming up, and hopefully we'll be broadcasting it from Italy in the next few weeks. So that's why we don't want to say too much. But this newly discovered veil is really, truly fascinating. I will say that I don't believe it is the Veil of Veronica, but I do believe that it has some very, very interesting information to convey to us. More to be discovered. But the interesting thing about it was, you know, we were in Lourdes and we were both kind of frustrated and sad. You know, these kinds of experiences make me sad, especially when I'm in Lourdes and I'm looking at the thousands of people who are coming there because they are legitimately looking for some kind of healing, either for themselves or someone that they love. And I see people, hundreds and hundreds of them, coming from the busloads in wheelchairs and with crutches and who are clearly in some kind of physical distress. And they're coming to this place because they're praying for a miracle. But I also know that they're spending hundreds, even thousands of dollars to get these gigantic candles and to be the person who gets their prayer at the front of the line. And that distresses me a lot. So, you know, here we were in Lourdes. I was kind of frustrated. I was angry. I wasn't feeling great about anything. And all of a sudden we turn around and we see this enormous sign that says they're having an exhibition on the Monopolo Veil. And we both went, oh my gosh, you know, there's this huge, huge banner with a picture of the Monopoly Veil. Philip had the book with him, and it was actually, you know, the book cover had been, you know, sitting there in front of us that, you know, that day in the house where we were staying. And so we said, okay, well, this is why we're in Lourdes, because we came here maybe to go and see this exhibition. And as it turned out, I think it was the last day of the exhibition, and it was the last hour of the exhibition, and it was closing in a few minutes. And I mean, we really sort of just got in there at the nick of time to see this exhibition. And I'm really, really glad we did, because in spite of the fact that we are going to Italy, we are going in search of the veil and the people around it, and we're going to be doing some real work on that, there was information that had been put together for this exhibition that was truly fantastic, that showed the different layers of cloth that could have been used in Jewish burial. It showed how the sudarium, how the Oviedo cloth, how the Shroud of Turin could have been placed together. There were fantastic diagrams. There was a lot of really amazing information about these relics that we now know, you know, could all be linked together as authentic relics from the first century. And we even discovered another relic that we didn't know existed in France.
Absolutely, the so-called Holy Cap of Cahors. And you had been to Cahors. I had driven past it but never stopped. And the Holy Cap of Cahors is basically the notion that when you are dead, the jaw of the dead person quite often drops. And the Jewish customs, of course, are that only family members are allowed to touch the body of a deceased person, which makes it both extremely disturbing, of course, because the closest people are also the ones who are going to be in most distress and who want to have the best experience and kind of like, you know, want to take care of this body. So the cap basically was a piece of cloth which was taken around the jaw. I think the best description is like when you look at the old comics when people had toothache. This is how they resolved the situation in a comical sense. And that really is what the holy cap was, or what the cap was supposed to do within the Jewish burial traditions,
It was
which
like
was.
a chin strap that came up to the top of the head and tied at the top of the head.
And so Cahors lays claim to this. We Googled it and Wikipedia'd it and found that it was indeed in Cahors. We went to Cahors. We went to the church in Cahors and we saw a beautiful altar to the Holy Cap. We saw a chapel which was dedicated to the Holy Cap. But what was missing was the Holy Cap.
By the way, before we go any further, this is a cautionary tale about Wikipedia. Now, Philip and I both know better than to trust Wikipedia, but as it was, we could not find any other information on this cap. We found some references to it, but as you know, Googling in French and in English, we could not get any info. So the only reference we could find was Wikipedia, and Wikipedia told us it was on display in this church. So for those of you who think that Wikipedia is a good source, here's what you need to know.
Well, it's on display sometimes once a year,
Maybe.
maybe, but not since really 1947, which I believe in 1947 Wikipedia didn't exist yet. In fact, the internet didn't exist. And the reason why we found this out was that Cahors and the cathedral actually sits on a line of pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. And there are, in this case, two elderly men who spend their time there welcoming and speaking to visitors, most of them who are pilgrims and who want to have information, which was how I found out that the last time a procession was organized involving the Holy Cap was in 1947. Cahors is a cathedral which is undergoing massive restoration work. In fact, as a complete side note, apparently some of the stained glass which is being restored is actually going to be the first one done which is using digital kind of printing technology. The story goes that because it's a cathedral, there is this tension between the church and the state. The state takes supervision and basically leases it out to the church. But in the case of Cahors, it's clear that this has resulted in quite a bit of tension. And in 1947, for reasons which are not clearly specified, but which conform to a general line, which is hide all the relics, quick, quick, quick. The holy cap, which used to sit in the central chapel behind the altar, was removed from there to a side chapel, which is locked, and which remains locked. You can't. We kind of like tried to look through the keyhole, and got some sense of it. But basically, it's never opened. Sometimes the church and the state get it together in a coordinated effort to either open up that chapel for a special one-day-only kind of event celebrating it. They try to do this once a year, but it is never for sure. Quite often they fail. And as a result of that, the people of Cahors have been denied pretty much a procession, which was their crowning glory. According to the guides, including that trusted source, Wikipedia, also the Holy Cap was given to the city of Cahors as a result of a crusade in the 12th century. But when we got there and we were looking in the chapel, again, a different story emerged.
Well, we get to the chapel, and this is why we say you must always do your research in the place where it exists, because as we see, a lot of the references and sources are not dependable. The books that we have found on the cap all say that it came back through the Crusades. However, when you are in the church, you see that this is absolutely not the case. There are stained glass windows and there are plaques in the church that tell you that this church was built to house the relic that Charlemagne brought and donated to the people of Cahors. So now all of a sudden we have references to the Holy Cap going back to the 700s, 500 years earlier, coming with Charlemagne being brought to this place from Charlemagne himself. So, you know, this is why it's this kind of research is so complicated, because you really can't do it in a library. You can't do it online. You've really got to go to the places where this lives in order to find it. So now all of a sudden we have a relic from the time of the Passion that we have dating back to at least Charlemagne's time in terms of how it's recorded. And this is an exceptional thing, and nobody talks about it, and nobody can see it, and it's not on display, and there's not anything you can do about it. This is considered to be one of the authentic relics of the Passion. Actually, everyone around it seems to be 1,000,000% certain that this is absolutely an important, authentic relic. And it will never cease to astound me that so many of these things that are considered to be authentic are just sort of locked away. It was the same thing when we were in Oviedo. Actually, that show that we did from Oviedo is one of my favorite Spirit Revolution shows. And if you have an interest in this idea of holy relics and things like the Shroud of Turin, you definitely should check out the Oviedo show from our archives, because I really... That whole process of being in Oviedo and experiencing that was so extraordinary. And once again, it's something that nobody talks about. It's something that when you're in Oviedo, you have to ask about. And even still, people will sometimes shrug and say, don't know what you mean, even in the church. There is this weird conspiracy of silence. I think in the case of Cahors, it's not even a conspiracy of silence so much as it's an issue of bureaucracy and people trying to figure out where it should go and who should take care of it and if it belongs to the church or to the state. But as a result, what you have is this extraordinary relic that is authenticated from at least Charlemagne's time. It is believed to be a part of the Passion, and nobody has any access to it, and nobody even talks about it. It's completely forgotten.
Absolutely. And speaking about forgotten, we then made our pilgrimage to past London, to Liverpool, to the sanctuary of the Holy Beatles. And I've got to say, we were there with the boys, two of the three, and we were just going to show them the places which were connected to the lives of the likes of, you know, John, Ringo, Paul,
George. There's four of them, honey. John, Paul, George, Ringo. You can tell which one of us is the big Beatles fan and which one maybe is not such a big Beatles fan.
And we were kind of like, expecting first of all to be taken. First of all, we thought we were going to take a kind of like a the bus tour, the Fab Four bus tour, I believe. Which,
The Magical Mystery Tour.
as opposed to the other company. And when we got there, we were basically told by the hotel that there was hardly any price difference between four of us on a bus and four of us in a private taxi hire, which they offered as well. And rather than basically being driven around in the bus, which obviously can only go into certain streets in certain places because it's a big object, the taxi was able to stop more and then go take you to more places. So we booked that, and at 10 o'clock the following morning, we were welcomed by a typical
Oh, he
Liverpoolian
was so fabulous.
lad, Joey, who, if ever you want to do the Beatles tour, definitely write to us, and we will glad you give you his coordinates because he is one of the funniest tour guides I have ever witnessed, and you will have a divine experience seeing his Liverpool through his eyes with him as he takes you to all of these sites. There are four Beatles, or are there five? And then the question all of a sudden came about as to how the fifth Beatle, which kind of people, I believe, know about, but how even you, as a Beatles fan, a person who's been to Liverpool on a previous occasion with television cameras in tow, you basically realized that after everything you had known about the Beatles, there was still a completely unknown story involving the Beatles.
Well, this is really, Liverpool was sacred ground for me. It always has been because I am a gigantic Beatles fan, not just because their music is divine, but because they were spirit revolutionaries. I mean, when you talk about spirit revolution, John Lennon is in my top 10 of all time spirit revolutionaries, absolutely. And actually, so is George Harrison. The things that George Harrison did for charity, the way that he was motivated to use his art and his fame to change the world and make it a better place. And certainly all of John and Yoko's efforts for peace. I mean, these were true spirit revolutionaries. And I have certainly always been a gigantic fan. As you mentioned, when I was 18 years old, I was in Liverpool for the first time 30 years ago through an amazing series of events. I actually ended up there with a camera crew from the Today Show and ended up on national television climbing around Liverpool with Today Show cameras following me in the summer of 1981. So I have been there before. I've loved it. I've been a Beatles fan for as long as I've been alive. My parents will tell you that my first complete sentence was Beatles, Beatles, Beatles. I was 11 months old, actually 10 and a half months old, I think, when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And my parents will tell you that I was watching it and standing with my hand on the coffee table because I couldn't quite walk by myself yet. And I was screaming, Beatles, Beatles, Beatles. So I was one of those girls who screamed for the Beatles in 1964. So, I know a lot about them. I've spent a lot of my life listening to them and studying them. And I certainly knew the story of Pete Best, the original drummer. He was the original drummer with the Beatles. All Beatles fans know that, and most people who know anything about pop culture know that, and that ultimately poor Pete was ousted and replaced by Ringo. To this day, no one really knows for sure the whole story behind what happened with Pete Best, and most of us kind of chalk this up to a it's a piece of pop culture history, kind of unfortunate. Poor Pete, he kind of got the shaft, and isn't it too bad he didn't get to ride the wave of all this, Beatlemania and everything else. I think we all kind of leave it there, and the rest of it is, Ringo becomes a Beatle, and the rest is history. But our taxi driver, the phenomenal Joey, is who took us to so many places, and we had so much fun with him. But he did, amazing things like, introducing us to the woman who lives in Ringo's house, and then she brings you in and she shows you pictures, and all of a sudden you're not a tourist, you're in the middle of these people's homes in Liverpool, and really hearing about how, you know, growing up with the Beatles and being in these neighborhoods with them as kids, you know, how it shaped their lives and changed them, and also how they're all doing amazing things. Just another aside, there's this woman named Margaret who lives in Ringo's house, and because so many people come in to see her, she raises money for Linda McCartney's cancer charity. So she has a little cup there, and she'll show you pictures, and she lets you photograph anything inside that you want, and she says, "Look, you can take pictures for free. I'll never charge anyone to come into Ringo's house, but if you can make any kind of donation to this charity, I would appreciate it." And we did, and apparently a lot of people do because she has little certificates around saying how much money she's raised for them. So it's lovely to see people doing this.
Over $11,000 she had raised, obviously in pounds, £8,000.
Wonderful, Margaret. So, in the middle of all this, Joey says, "Now, do you want to have a real Beatles experience? Do you want to see real Liverpool? Do you want to see where all this really got started? Because I'd like to take you to a place that nobody goes. I'd like to take you to the Casbah Club. Do you know about the Casbah?" Well, as a diehard Beatles fan, I did know that prior to the Cavern, which everyone knows about, the Beatles got their start at the Cavern Club on Matthew Street in Liverpool. I did know that there was an earlier club called the Casbah Club, but I didn't know that much about it. And Joey said, no, you need to see this place. This place, the Casbah, is the real deal. And if you guys want to go, I'll take you there." And so he did. And basically, the Casbah Club opened up this thing for me about the history of the Beatles that I never expected, because it's all about how a woman is really responsible for the beginning of the Beatles, and nobody talks about it. So for me, there was this element of feminist history happening here. You know, I'm always looking for the story of the lost woman, and boy, is there one. And I'm going to be writing about her soon. I'm going to write an article. I'm hoping that the family might work with me on this a little bit to get some information. But this was the family of Pete Best. His mother, Mona Best, amazing character, created the Casbah Club so that her kids, her boys, she had three sons, would have a place to hang out with their friends. And she created something called the Casbah Coffee Club. No alcohol, this was a coffee club, but she wanted it to be a music club and a place for the teenagers to come, play their music, and hang out. Amazing mom.
And precisely, you know, she understood that the 50s and the 60s were bringing about this new phenomenon of the teenager, which before didn't really exist, before you went from a child to an adult. And after the Second World War, teenagers began to exist. And she had no idea, and I think we still haven't resolved that enigma, as to what to do with them sometimes. And so, in the case of Britain, where the licensing laws are that you cannot go into a pub until the age of 18, no alcohol is allowed. All of a sudden, the question kind of was, well, what do children do? Where do they go to? What can they do? And she was very fortunate that her husband was quite wealthy. He organized various boxing events and other events across Britain. They found a house where they lived, and she converted the bottom cellar bit really into the Casbah Coffee Club.
She had seen a film called Algiers, and she thought it would be really great if kids could say to each other, "Come with me to the Casbah." And so that's why she called it the Casbah Coffee Club. So there was a lot about it that was just really, it was fun and interesting and playful. I mean, this woman really got it. Like, she knew how she was gonna create this space for her boys. And as a mother of boys, a teenage boys at that age as well, who were musicians, I felt this absolute connection to her and what she tried to create. But the amazing thing about this place is what a museum it is. The Casbah Coffee Club is intact the way that Mona Best created it with her son and her son's friends in the late 50s and early 60s. And you know, the guides to your to the coffee club when you are there are Pete Best's brothers, Rory and Rogue. We had Rory was our guide, and he was wonderful. And they have such a passion for this story because they lived it. This was their life. This was their family. But when you go through the club, it's like, well, and here's the ceiling that Paul painted, and here's the ceiling that John painted. It's a living museum to the Beatles and the stories that they can tell you about You know, how Mona inspired all of them. And they all did this for Mona. These kids came in here. They, you know, John was an art student. He came in, he painted the ceiling. There's a wonderful story about how he painted the ceiling the first time and she hated it and made him do it again. And then he painted it green. And she said, I told you I hate green. You know, I hate green. Why did you paint it green? Paint it again. And then he finally said, what do you want me to do? You know, and so she gave him some very specific instructions and he painted it again. And so the entire ceiling was painted by John Lennon. There's another place where the ceiling was painted by Paul. There's another place where John and Paul and Pete all painted stars on the ceiling. Actually, one of the stars was sold at an auction and they cut a piece of the ceiling out. This was prior to 2006. It's a listed building now and they can't do that anymore. But prior to 2006, they had cut one of the stars off and sold it at an auction. And based on the number of stars that are in the ceiling and what the stars are worth, that ceiling is worth over £1 million now, just based on, you know, what the kids painted. But beyond that, the place is really priceless. When you walk into it, it's like walking back in time. It's this amazing time capsule of what things were like. But this story of Mona Best was all about how she nurtured these kids. She gave them a place to be who they were. And she was, in essence, really their first manager. She was the one who took care of them. She's actually the one who also ultimately got them their gig at the Cavern Club and connected them to Brian Epstein, their first manager. So this amazing woman, Mona Best, really was there at the very beginning, when Pete became a Beatle. And she was also there when they let Pete go for no reason and with no explanation. And so all of a sudden, this woman who had been the godmother of this band, who had taken care of these kids, you know, one of the books, one of the things I was reading, one of the books said, you know, Mona Best cared about these kids when nobody else did. You know, sometimes she was the only mother that any of them had. She fed them and, you know, clothed them and cared for them and gave them a place to be. And so, you know, for me as a mother, hearing this story of Mona Best, all I could think of is after she had done all this and built them and created the Beatles and bought them clothes and got them to Hamburg and did all of these things that she did, for them ultimately, as they're on the verge of success, to dump Pete and cut him with no explanation and then cut off the family the way that they did is such a heartbreaking story. And as a mother, it absolutely got to me at the deepest part of my maternal self. And I just thought, wow, this woman's story is a story that I would love more people to know about. There is a book written by the Best Brothers that we picked up when we were there at the Casbah called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. And if you are a real Beatle fan or someone who just really cares about pop culture, you need to pick up this book. It is so interesting and so much fun. The BBC News refers to the Casbah Club as popular culture's Sistine Chapel because of the way that everything has been painted actually by the Beatles. And there's a great painting, a silhouette of John Lennon that was painted there by Cynthia when they were still dating in the club there together right before they got married. So it's fantastic. It was an amazing experience, but for me, it was just another great episode of female history that I think needs to be told, to be explored. I would love to see this story of Mona Best go a little bit farther and see something made of her story. So stay tuned. I'm gonna see if the Best Brothers will talk to me about doing that. Who knows? But even if they don't, definitely pick up this book. Take a look at the Casbah Club online. I think you can Google it. And I think it's casbahcoffeeclub.com if you want to take a look at some of the things that are going on there. If you're a Beatle fan, really, really interesting stuff.
And that brings us to the final topic, which is something which I'm putting on my website this Friday and which literally came into my head today as a fully formed thought. Over the past year, since the Ancient Alien question has come out, there have always been people who, specifically what I would say, people who are of a profile whereby they love science fiction, who love all of the things as to whether science fiction or not can be real, and obviously things like aliens and UFOs has a strong presence in the science fiction community. Star Trek, Star Wars, all of those things. And quite often there are two types of people, and there's like one person who I quite often would describe as, we love science fiction, maybe it's real, but we are really science fiction fans. Something of a geekish attitude towards them. And what I find hard to deal with is that quite often these people are more influenced by the science fiction they read. And one of the things they read is things about, you know, the zoo hypothesis. And the zoo hypothesis basically says this, that you know, it comes out of science, and basically science a few decades ago was confronted with realization that everything pointed out to the conclusion that life was everywhere in the universe. The universe was teeming with it. So why weren't we being contacted? Because obviously this is the, you know, no matter what you put forward, no matter what evidence of an ancient alien or a UFO you put forward, whether it's Roswell, whether it's anything else, there are people, and specifically kind of like, you know, the scientists involved, who will basically say, but there is no evidence. ET has never been here. So how is this possible? How is this paradox existing? The fact that life is everywhere in the universe and obviously here on Earth, but why hasn't life in the universe contacted us? And so the zoo hypothesis was created. And it's the zoo hypothesis basically says this, that out there are aliens, but they don't contact us because somehow we haven't reached a certain level of what I would say, awareness or understanding or evolution, and that until we do so, we are basically kept apart or left alone. And obviously in Star Trek, this was becoming the prime directive, which basically is that somehow there is a federation of planets out there who keeps us from contacting us. And the moment in time which Gene Roddenberry from Star Trek took as this point when we are far enough advanced is basically the point when we have created faster than light propulsion, because with that faster than light propulsion, we basically would be able to go out into space and make contact with other civilizations as well. And as a result of that, it's the point chosen by this federation to basically reveal themselves and say, hey, guess what, guys, you're not alone in the universe. And the zoo, you know, the kind of like the zoo ends there. So all of these science fiction people use this, whether it's Arthur Clarke, Gene Roddenberry, it appears in Star Wars, Robert Heinlein, they all use it. And so you have, if your mind is formed by science fiction reading, you really come to this, and you basically discard everything about reality, and you propose the zoo hypothesis on everything because it's your line of thinking. And, well, I got kind of fed up with that because it's one of those things which constantly are, you know, kind of like the questions which I have to answer. And I felt that when I put it in writing, maybe, you know, kind of like people will stop asking me the question. And that's obviously something which will have to be seen in the future. But instead, I put forward something else, which is called the nursery hypothesis. And the nursery hypothesis basically, you know, takes the evidence of our ancestors as a starting point. And that is this. All civilizations, whether they are the Inca, whether they are the Egyptians, whether they are the Mayans, always said that this path of civilization was walked with a non-human intelligence next to them. That whenever mankind wanted to do something and it couldn't do it on their own, they called in the help of a guide who didn't come down from a spaceship and said, oh, I'll build the Great Pyramid for you. It didn't work like that. But basically somebody kind of like, you know, you go to for advice or help when you say, I want to build a pyramid, but I have no idea how to do it, or I have no idea how to do it in a certain way. Can you help me? To which the answer is yes. And here is how we're going to work through this together. On a practical level like that, but also that the greater scheme of things, the fact, the awareness of kind of like, you know, every human being should be like, do we have a soul? Is there an afterlife? How all of these big questions, which today are not addressed, our ancestors was always saying that there were non-human intelligences there who were able to give them experiences and understanding and knowledge about what happened to the soul, about what the soul was, and all of these things. And that this was knowledge which came from these civilizing deities who've gone down into history by the names of Quetzalcoatl, Viracocha, Osiris, and so many others. And so this is like the nursery hypothesis, which basically says that we are not alone, that we are contacted on a basis which we want to have, and that we really only need to ask for advice. It's very much like, asking a school teacher or whoever is not necessarily even in charge, but who's there out there for advice and help, and that at that moment in time, contact will be established. And this is, I think, the core of the Ancient Alien Question, my book as well, which basically says, which gives advances of the likes of Terence McKenna and how he got advanced knowledge, in his case, on the nature of time, when he established such contact, when he said, yes, I want to experience different realities and make contact with non-human intelligences. And so I'm kind of like putting it out there on Friday and see where it's going to go. But at the very least, I hope that it's a talking point which stops people constantly going back to the zoo hypothesis, which really, again, is something which fiction has created. And I find it interesting that so many people, have their thinking dictated by science fiction to the point that they argue away real historical facts. The humankind, it's an interesting species.
Well, let me ask, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this as someone who does not live in that science fiction world, and is somewhat new to these theories, because I had never heard of this zoo theory until today, when you explained it to me. So just to make sure I'm getting this right, so the kind of existing popular theory, this zoo theory, is that essentially as the earthlings are animals in a zoo, and the extraterrestrial intelligences are the zookeepers. And they have a hands-off policy, and they kind of watch us in our little terrariums, but they don't get involved. Whereas what you're proposing, which is a whole lot nicer, certainly a warmer and more positive, and I think likely approach, is that we are learning here, and there are extraterrestrial intelligences or higher intelligences who are there to help us learn and help us guide and to teach us. And this goes back to the fact that the ancients understood this, and they knew how to ask for help, and how to communicate with these higher intelligences and get that help. Am I correct?
You are absolutely correct.
Gold star for me.
Absolutely. Which brings us to the end of another episode of The Spirit Revolution. There will be more coming. But before we do so, we're asking you to help somebody who has been featured on our radio show. We have played some of her music in the past, and that is the Divine Devayani. Apart from being an extremely good friend of ours, she is truly an angelic artist. And these days, specifically in France, where the infrastructure is far less widespread than in places like New York or LA, getting into a recording studio is still something which costs an awful lot of money because there are few, and you basically have to pay the full pot.
So what Devayani is doing is she has a campaign to get people to help her with the recording fees for her new CD. She has 12 new pieces that she has been working on. We have been blessed enough to hear some of them in action as she's played them for our groups when we take them to see her. She actually comes to us in France. She plays for a lot of people for free. If you have not heard her music, we're going to play a piece for you in a minute. It is absolutely spectacular. She really works with these energies of Cather Country. I refer to her as my Cather little sister. But these energies and essences of this part of the world, this incredibly powerful, mystical, spiritual part of the world, really move through Devayani into her music. And listening to her music is such a divine experience. And so we're excited to see her create a new CD. But in order for the expenses of the recording studio to be paid, she needs to pre-sell some CDs. She's going into the studio in September. The CD will be done by Christmas. If you would like to pre-order Devayani's CD, or contribute to her recording expenses in any other way. There is also the opportunity to become a sponsor and to be involved with this process of recording. The best way to do that is to go to Facebook. Go into your Facebook and put in Devayani, Devayani, and you will see the page that says Devayani Pianist. And pull that up, and that is her page. You will like her Facebook page, and you'll see there it says New CD 2012. If you click on New CD 2012, it tells you, takes you right there to how to contribute. You can do it all through PayPal. It's super simple.
If you want to meet Devayani live, you obviously have to come to France. And today, a few hours ago, we announced our Sacred France 2013 trips. There are two. They are occurring in May, and they are back to back because basically the way it is done is that you can opt for one, but you can also take two of them because they kind of like one follows on from the other. And definitely next year, Devayani will once again be playing live for us as she has been doing both last year and this year. Her music is definitely something which moves people. And we had no idea last year how many people were going to be personally affected by her music. It is almost as I would say the equivalent of going to a psychiatrist and getting some therapy to unblock certain things. People really have found her music transformational. And so if you want to listen to that music, either on iTunes, either in real life, go to iTunes in the first case. For the second case, go to sacredfrance.com, where you will see our tours advertised. But we have come to the end of this spiritual revolution, and we are going to leave you with some music of Devayani. But before, if you want to listen to our shows or some of our previous shows, like for example on the Elevator Sudarium, you can go to iTunes as well because we are there. Our main page, however, remains thespiritrevolution.com, where you will also be able to listen to the five last episodes of The Spirit Revolution, as well as see an overview of the guests which we have been featuring since January 2010 when this show began. We leave you with the music of Devayani, but before we, as usual, bid you farewell.
The truth against the world.